Yeah, well, Cambodia. Anything I should know? He forced a grin. A lot of stuff you'd like to know, probably. But let's talk about Mars. She threw the towel at him. I'll get it out of you, she promised, advancing. The next morning, on the way to work, Mike's tone came back to him, and he wondered if the other man was going to have another go after the Cambodia briefing. He rehearsed angry rejoinders in his head as the cab swung around Hyde Park Corner. He never got a chance to use them. It was the day Hollywood chose to come calling, and all Mike wanted to talk about were the hallucinatory figures involved and the possibility that they might get to watch themselves immortalized on screen by Tony Carpenter or Eduardo Rojas. Carla called a couple more times that week, and then, suddenly, she was at the front desk, asking for him. Mercifully, it was a night Liz Linshaw had chosen not to show up. He thought, briefly, cruelly, about telling the desk staff to send her away, then caught a glimpse of himself in a wall mirror and grimaced. He changed into something freshly laundered, slipped on a pair of casual shoes, and went down to face her. She was sitting on one of the sofas in reception, immaculate in faded jeans he remembered buying with her, boots, and a neat black leather jacket. When she saw him, she got up and came to meet him, trying for a smile.
So, I get an audience with a man of the moment. Feeling good, being famous again?
What do you want?
Can we go up to your room?
No. She looked elaborately around the quiet, well-bred bustle of the lobby. The hurt barely showed in her voice.
Have you got someone up there?
Don't be a fucking bitch. No, I haven't got anyone up there. Jesus, Carla, this isn't about someone else. You fucking left me.
So I've got to stand here while you shout at me?
He swallowed and lowered his voice. There's a bar through there, through that arch. We can sit in there. She shrugged, but it was a manufactured detachment. In the corner of the bar she sat and stared at him out of eyes that shone with unshed tears. She'd been crying recently, he knew. He could tell. He felt a tiny thawing at the edges of his anger at the knowledge, a tiny aching warmth. He crushed it out. A uniformed waitress appeared with an expectant smile. He ordered Lafrague for himself, and asked Carla whether she'd like something to drink, and watched the formality of his tone stab her through. She shook her head.
I didn't come here to drink with you, Chris.
Fair enough. He nodded to the waitress, and she went back to the bar. What did you come for?
To apologize.
He looked at her for a long moment. Go on, then. She managed a smile, shook her head.
You bastard. You've turned into a real bastard, Chris. You know that?
You left me in the middle of the fucking zones, Carla. At 2 o'clock in the fucking morning. You've got some apologizing to do.
You called me a whore.
And you called me... He gestured helplessly, not remembering how the fight had stoked so high. You said...
I said I couldn't recognize you any more, Chris. It wasn't an insult. It was the truth. I don't recognize you any more.
He shrugged, ignored the tiny acid drip at the center of his chest. So why come here at all? I'm a write-off. I'm unrecoverable, tender trash. So why waste your time?
I told you why I came.
Yeah, to apologize. You're not making a very good job of it. The Lafrague came. He signed for it, sipped, and put it down on the table between them. He looked back up at Carla. Well?
I didn't come to apologize for leaving you in the zones.
He opened his mouth, and she made a slashing gesture to silence him.
No, listen to me, Chris. I'd do it again if you spoke to me like that again. You deserved it.
She stared away across the bar, assembling what she wanted to say. Absently, she reached across the table for the whiskey tumbler, recognized the automatic intimacy for what it was, and stopped herself rigidly. She blinked a couple of times, fast.
That's not what I have to apologize for, Chris. I have to apologize because I should have left you a long time ago. I've spent the last year, the last 2 years, I don't know, maybe even longer than that, trying to turn you back into the man I thought you were when we first met."
She smiled unconvincingly.
"And you don't want to be that man any more, Chris. You aren't that man any more. You've found something harder and faster, and you like it better."
"This is crap, Carla."
"Is it?"
Silence. A tear broke cover under her left eye. He pretended not to see it, reached for his whiskey instead. She found a tissue in her jacket.
"I'm leaving you, Chris. I thought, maybe. But I was right the first time. There's no point."
She gestured at the hotel around them.
"You're happier like this, living on room service, locking out the rest of the world. It isn't just the job you do anymore, that fucking tower you run your remote control wars from. It's everything, 24/7, insulated from reality. How long would you have gone on sitting in this place if I hadn't come here tonight? How long would you have shut me out like everyone else?"
She got up abruptly. He sat, staring straight ahead, out the windows of the bar to the street outside. "You fucking left me, Carla. Don't try to turn it around." She gave him a bright, brittle smile.
"You're not listening to me, Chris. I'm leaving you. I'll need a couple of weeks to get my stuff out of the house."
"And where are you going to go?" It came out ugly.
"I'm going to stay with..."
She laughed a little.
"Not that it's anything to do with you any more, Chris. I'm going to stay in Tromsø for a while, until I can get the divorce sorted out. I'm assuming you aren't going to contest it. You'll probably be happier than I am to get free. Give you plenty of room for your new penthouse playmate, whoever she is."
"What the fuck are you talking about?"
"Oh, please, I'm not stupid, Chris. I saw the way the people at the desk looked at me when I asked for you. I hear the way they react when I try to call you. I'm not the only woman you've got coming here. I just hope whoever it is worth what you're paying."
He shrugged. "Think what you like. Better yet, check the credit card accounts. Spot all the charges to escort agencies I must be making. You never did have a very high opinion of me, did you?" She shook her head, drew a hard breath that had tears in it.
"You don't know how wrong you are about that, Chris. You'll never fucking know."
"Yeah, whatever." She turned to go, paused and turned back.
"Oh, yeah. You'd better come out and collect the Saab, Chris. Sometime soon. I haven't touched it, but I'm not sure how long I can stand it sitting there in the drive while I know you're here fucking some moan-on-demand tit job. My maturity's wearing pretty fucking thin."
She walked away from him. Chapter 41 Liz Linshaw came over the following evening and walked bang into the aftermath. Chris was moody and snappish, and when they got into bed he needed a hand-crank start. They fucked, but it wasn't much fun. He went through the motions, wrestling irritably over choices and changes of posture, and only finally managed to lose himself in the pay-channel perfection of her body as he came. Scant seconds later, he hit the real world like concrete from 50 floors up. No post-coital warmth, no chuckling or smoothing of sweat-soaked skin. There was a raw hollow behind his eyes and in his chest. They unplugged and lay apart.
"Thanks,"
she said, staring at the ceiling. "Sorry." He rolled toward the juncture of her thighs.
"Come here."
She pushed his head away.
"Forget it, Chris. Just tell me what's wrong."
"You don't want to hear it."
"Yes, I do."
He rolled onto his back again. He blew imaginary cigarette smoke at the ceiling. "Carla came to see me," he said finally.
"Great."
She sat up against the headboard, arms folded under her breasts.
"Fucking great. You seeing her again?"
"Told you didn't want to hear it." She looked down at him, angry.
"You're wrong. I do want to hear it. I want to hear all about it, every fucking detail. You're what I do in the evenings now, Chris.
Anything that's going to ruin it this badly, you better believe I want to hear about it. Are you seeing her again?
Doubt it.
He recounted the conversation in the bar almost word for word. When he came to Carla's parting line, she grimaced.
Nice.
Yeah. Chris stared off into a corner of the room. Used to scare me sometimes. How she could get inside my head like that. Just read stuff out of me like I was a screen.
Liz Linshaw's gaze twitched around.
Excuse me?
I mean, the way she knew that...
That's what I am in your head? A moan-on-demand tit job? Well, thanks a fucking lot, Chris. Thank you very much.
Liz, I'm not... That's not what I meant. It's...
He groped after some explanation of what he meant, the way she seemed to form an integrated part of the smooth-lined hotel suite reality he was living.
Christ, you're beautiful. That's what I was trying to say. Too beautiful to be real, it seems like. Okay? And that must have been what she picked up on in my head. I mean, look, she was right about the tit job, wasn't she?
Liz cupped her breasts at him. The anger on her face robbed it of sexuality.
You got a problem with these? Funny, because you didn't seem to earlier when your face was fucking buried between them. You know, Chris, this is me. I'm here for real, all of me. I'm not trying to sell myself to you as some piece of fucking merchandise.
No?
A little of his own anger was starting to seep back through the emptiness under his ribs. So why send me the edited highlights of your porn career? Good old airbrushed girl-on-girl action. You wouldn't call that merchandise in the goods?
She stared at him.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Oh, come on, Liz. You're trying to tell me you didn't do porn?
No, I did.
Something in her face had changed.
Back when it was the best way I knew to make money. I just want to know how come you never told me you'd been jerking off to it.
Liz, you fucking sent it to me.
No, Chris, I didn't.
You're saying you didn't mail me a video clip of you and some blonde bimbette on a, like, an exercise rack or something. You never sent that?
She sighed and sank back against the headboard. Her gaze rolled out to the middle distance. She seemed to curl into herself.
Donna's Dominion, she muttered.
Sorry?
Donna's Dominion. That's what it was called, that particular piece of classy erotic art. I was Donna Dread, gym training world dominatrix.
She smiled without much mirth.
Pretty infantile stuff, huh?
Chris gestured uncomfortably. He was pretty sure he was blushing. Liz Linshaw nodded.
Got you hard, though, right?
He looked away.
She sighed again.
Look, don't worry about it. Stuff's made to get you hard. As a male, you'd be practically dysfunctional if it didn't. Youthful tits are supposed to turn you on, and there you've got four of them on screen, all rubbing up against each other and all blown up to hyper-real proportions. You might as well get embarrassed about four lines of uncut name powder keeping you awake all night. It's just another drug, Chris. Refined, maxed up, bang on the nail, sex chemistry trigger dust.
Another weary smile.
So you liked me, huh?
He cleared his throat. Were you really into, you know?
Girls?
She shrugged.
Not really, no. I mean, get someone licking your clit for you, that's not unpleasant, whatever sex the person doing it is. Once you get used to the six or seven people watching you off camera, that is. And you'd be surprised how quick you do get used to that. But no, I was never a try-out lesbian. Not even a tryout bi. It's pure theatre, Chris. Just a job. Oh, yes. And if you stick to girl on girl, your health insurance premiums go way down. Less risk. Less general wear and tear on the works.
Why did you... I mean, how did you get into it?
This time her smile seemed genuine. Her posture unwound. She shook her head, reached over the edge of the bed for her bag, and started going through it.
Well, I wasn't kidnapped into it by white slavers, if that's what you mean.
She found a bent and crumpled, ready-rolled spliff, a lighter, sat back against the headboard again and lit up. She coughed and waved little eddies in the sudden cloud of smoke.
You want some of this? No?
Sure? She pulled down a lungful of smoke, held it for a moment, and let go. She looked critically at the embered end of the spliff.
Thing is, you listen to some twisted evangelical fuck like Simeon Sands, you'd believe we are all sex slaves by any other name, kidnapped, trapped by drugs, victims of our own unclean, incest-aroused lust. I think guys like Sands like that one especially. You hear the way they trot it out? One hand on the pulpit, one hand below, eh?
She grinned crookedly.
But it just ain't so, Chris. I mean, it isn't this other thing the industry wants to sell you either. You know, we're all dripping wet sluts. Just can't wait to get our orifices stuffed. Forget that. You want clinical and jaded, go watch a porno shoot. It's work, Chris. Pure and simple. More or less professional, depending on who you're working for. Better or worse paid, ditto. But no one ever put me under pressure to do stuff I wasn't happy with, and no one tried to stop me when I quit.
Do you think you were typical? Liz held down more smoke, frowned, then let it up, shook her head.
Globally? No. I heard a lot of nasty stories coming out of Costa Rica and Thailand. Still do. But you don't need me to tell you about that, Chris. This is what you do for a living. Enterprise zones, political instability, market forces, weak governmental structure, the poor get fucked. Literally, in this case.
Oh, right. The casual way she'd said it stung, made him snappish. So everyone you worked with was smiling and happy, were they? She plumed smoke, looked at him quizzically.
No. Even in Copenhagen you got some fucked-up girls working the trade. That blonde I was with in Donna's Dominion, Renata something, I think she was Polish. She had some strange ideas, and those tits were just insane. She had to go to 3 different plastics guys before she found one who'd give her those implants, and then she had on-and-off post-op trouble the whole time. So, yeah, who knows? Maybe old Simeon was right in her case. Turned on to pornographic filth because her father abused her as a child. But to be honest, I think she just wasn't very bright. Yeah, Chris. There are going to be women doing porn who were fucked up by abuse when they were kids. It makes sense. But most of the ones I worked with were just like me, uninhibited, maybe overly exhibitionistic media wannabes, marking time while they looked for their big break. I went out to Copenhagen, looking for work with a pirate casters out of Christiania. I got into Danish porn instead. It was easier. There was a lot more of it about than pirate work, and it was better paid. It was a couple of years, it felt weird and different, and maybe taught me a few things about myself that I wouldn't know otherwise, and I saved a lot of money. End of story. And happy ending. Yeah.
But you need to smoke that stuff to talk about it. The quizzical look again.
Chris, you need to get a grip. You're telling me you've really got some kind of moral problem with my career as a porn doll a decade ago? For a man who works in international finance, you've got some fucking nerve.
I don't have a problem with it. And I didn't think you had a problem with what I do either. Spite gleamed through. In fact, I thought it got you off. Her eyes narrowed.
What?
Sure. You fucked Mike Bryant, now you're fucking me. Spot the connection. Hey, I'm not complaining, Liz, but take a look at your own fucking motivations. This is textbook passenger seat passion. Let's be honest about it. She sat up abruptly, flicked ash off the spliff.
Yeah, that's a good idea, Chris. Let's be honest. If you had a problem with me, you could have left me well alone.
Left you alone? The injustice of it staggered him. It was like fighting with Carla all over again, an opening well of curdled hurt. You came on pretty fucking strong to me, as I recall. At Troy's party, after the party, at regime change. You called me for that one.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe you shouldn't have sent me a copy of your wife's flight times to Norway, then. Because, you know, Chris, as invitations go, that was pretty fucking blatant.
Shock held him unstirring for a moment. She caught it, coiled back on the bed, face still tight with anger.
What?
I... Liz, I didn't send you anything.
Right.
Now, fucking listen to me. He reached out for her with both hands. She gestured him away, stared out the window. I didn't send you that stuff. I didn't even know Carla was going to Tromsø until about an hour before you called me. Someone's fucking with us, Liz.
Her gaze tracked warily back to him. She didn't turn her head. Her whole body was closed to him again, limbs folded defensively.
I'm not a drive-site groupie, Chris.
Okay. He held up his hands, palms out. Okay, you're not a drive-site groupie, whatever you say. But I'm telling you, I never sent you those flight details. And you're telling me you didn't send me Donna's Dominion. So someone's fucking with us, right?
It's got to be that.
And he got her back, limb by limb, line by line, the softening stole through her. The place in Carla he could no longer reach, the point of reconciliation abraded by years of impact along the same emotional front. She opened a little, turned to face him, nodded. A tiny shard of hope spiked him, unlooked for, a prickle across the underside of each eye and a sudden surge in the empty space he'd excavated in his own chest. This time, he promised himself silently, this one, this time, this woman, I will not fuck this one up. But the hyena was still out there, still prowling in silhouette on the sunset horizon of his thoughts, and would not shut up. Chapter 42. He got to work early, running on residual anger that still had no clear focus. The data down rolled out its gathered screed of messages. Top of the line, Irina Renko. Subject, need loading fast. It wasn't the first time he'd seen the name in the last week. Something snapped.
For fuck's sake!
He hit reply, and listened to the dial.
Da?
Listen to me, you stupid fucking Natasha. I do not need your whore's services, now or ever. Just leave me the fuck alone.
There was a pause, during which he nearly hung up. Then the accented voice came back, icy with controlled rage.
"Just who the fuck you think you are talking to? Fucking suit cowboy? Think you will talk to me like this? I am Captain Irina Renko, commander of Free Subfreighter Kurt Cobain, talking to you."
"I'm sorry."
"You should fucking be sorry. Fuck your mother. 4 days I am here in Faslane, awaiting second loading. 4 days, my crew drunk in Glasgow bars. What for you waste my time like this?"
Wait, the Cobain?
Chris flailed across the desk and hit the data down deck. Details fled up into a new window.
"You're loading for the name? Military hardware?"
"No," purred the woman at the other end. "I am not loading, because I'm waiting 4 fucking days for cargo. Port authority know nothing. I call Lopez. He also knows nothing. Normally, Cobain, she sails and fuck you all if this happens. But Lopez tells me call you. You are sympathetic, he says, not like other suits. Perhaps I have wrong man."
No, Captain Renko, you have the right man. I apologize for my tone earlier. There's a lot going on at this end."
"Well, at this end is nothing going on. No delivery, no data about delivery, and mooring charge is costing me—"
"Never mind the mooring charge, I'll cover that, plus 10% for your inconvenience. Go get your crew. I'll get back to you."
He cut the connection and stared across the office. The marbled chessboard gleamed back at him, pieces frozen in a pattern that hadn't changed in weeks. He called Mike.
"Yeah, Bryant?"
"Mike, listen, we've got a problem."
"I'll say. I would have called you earlier, but I didn't see the Saab, didn't know you were in."
"It's still at home. I haven't been back for it yet."
A chilly quiet back down the line.
"Mike, I just heard from our couriers to Barranco."
"We haven't got time to worry about the name right now, Chris. Didn't you catch the news this morning? Fuck, last night even."
"No, last night I was kiss and make up fucking your ex-mistress. I went to bed early. Headache. And I'm coming in from the hotel in cabs at the moment. I don't get the radio either. What's going on?"
"Some fucking junior Langlier just came down with a bad dose of conscience. He's promised covert reports from the last 2 years to Scandinet and Freevid Montreal."
"Oh, fuck."
Yeah, what I said.
Cambodia?
We don't know yet. This gutless wonder at Langley worked archive, so could be the Phnom Penh stuff is too recent to show up, but we can't rely on that. There's no telling what he's going to give them.
Can't we just have the guy wiped?
Oh, what do you think Langley are trying to do right now? Chris, he worked for them. He was on the inside. You don't think he's going to have covered himself? He's grabbed the discs and gone underground.
Okay, so get someone else, someone better than Langley. Special Air, or one of the Israeli contractors.
Same applies, Chris. First, they've got to find the fucker. And meanwhile, Scandinet and FreeVid are leaking this fucking stuff like Vindaloo diarrhea. We're going to have the UN Charter people all over us by the end of the week at the outside.
Well, look. Chris frowned. Something didn't fit here.
Calm down. They don't have any power of access. All they can do is make a noise. We fight them in the courts. The whole thing boils down to 2 years' paperwork and legal wrangling.
What are you getting so bent out of shape about?
It's bad for fucking business, all right. Leakage of any sort. Kind of publicity we don't need.
Yeah, well, speaking of bad for business, you better get on to your pal Sally Hunting. I've just had a Russian sub-commander yelling at me because she's been waiting 4 days at Faslane for a name shipment that hasn't turned up.
There was a beat of silence.
What?
You heard. Baranko's mouse sticks have gone walkabout. No one at Faslane can find them.
That can't be.
There was an odd strain in the other man's voice.
Can be.
Is. Look, I'm going to ring Lopez in Panama, see if he knows anything. You get on to Sally, then call me back. Lopez wasn't answering. Chris hung up and was about to try again when the data down lit with an incoming video call from Philip Hamilton. He frowned again and picked up.
Yeah?
Hamilton's soft features resolved on the screen.
Ah, Chris, there you are.
Yeah. Still the vague sense of something out of place. He'd had almost no dealings with the junior partner since he joined Sean. Some of the Central American stuff he'd inherited from Macon brushed up against Hamilton's accounts, but...
What can I do for you, Philip?
Well, Chris... The junior partner's tone was silky. It's more a case of what I can do for you, I think. You've no doubt heard about the Langley crisis.
Yeah, Mike...
He just stopped himself. I was talking to Mike about it. Archive material, they reckon, suggests the Cambodia stuff might not be included.
That's correct.
Hamilton nodded, his chins folded.
In fact, we just got confirmation. Good news for everybody. Louise will probably forward it down to you shortly.
But, it seems there is one covert operation that will crop up, and unfortunately it has your name on it. I'm talking about the action you took against Hernan Echevarria's security forces in Medellin.
Now the sense of wrongness was quick and jagged, like the floor cracking apart under him. He covered it with drawl.
Yeah, so?
Well, I think under the circumstances, and given recent developments with the Echevarria regime, the best thing would probably be if you were removed from the name account, at least for the time being.
Chris sat up.
You can't fucking do that.
I beg your pardon?
What developments are you talking about, Philip? Last I heard, the Echevarria regime was a corpse walking.
Ah, yes.
Hamilton fingered his jowls. This also is new. Perhaps you'd better come along to the briefing this afternoon. I'd invited Mike and assumed he could pass on detail to you later, but yes, perhaps it's better if you're there. Main conference, 2 o'clock.
Chris stared at him. Right, I'll be there.
Marvellous.
Hamilton beamed and cut the link, his face inked out, still smiling.
Chris tried Lopez again. Still nothing. He windowed up an in-desp site he had the keys to and checked the Langley data. Nothing solid.
The whistleblower's face grinned out of an employee file thumbprint that was 5 years stale. He looked young and happy, and blissfully unaware of what his just-acquired job was going to do to him a few years down the road.
"Because they're going to fucking crucify you, son," Chris told the thumbprint silently. "They're going to take you apart for this."
The data down chimed. Audio call from Mike. He grabbed it.
"Talk to me, Mike. What's going on?"
"I don't know, Chris. I wish I did.
Sally says the order went through, but it's been diverted to some surface shipping contractor out of Southampton, standard cross-Atlantic rate. She's getting a cash-back bonus for the difference in cost.
Surface?
I know, I don't get it either. It's not like Barranco can wander into Barranquilla docks and just sign for it.
He stopped. Abruptly the spinning chaos of the last 10 minutes locked to a halt in his head. He saw the sense.
Mike, I'll call you back.
Wait, you...
He snapped the line across, sat staring at the data down for a full 30 seconds while the sudden weight in his guts settled.
Has to be, he knew. Fucking has to be.
He felt physically sick with the knowledge. He placed another call to Lopez, got the busy signal, and fired an override down the connection. There was a brief electronic squabble on the line as Sean's intrusion software fought with the Panama City net. Then Lopez came through, still talking to someone else in furious Spanish.
De puta! Me tienen media hora esperando!
Joaquin, listen to me.
De puta! Me tienen media hora esperando!
Joaquin, listen to me.
Chris? ¿Cómo has podido?
The America's agent stopped as his language caught up with the change of call.
Listen, Chris, what are you fucking playing at over there?
I don't know, Joaquin, I don't know. This shit only just landed on me, and I don't know what it is. Talk to me, man. I'm blind here. Tell me what's going on.
What's going on?
Said Lopez, rage spurting from every syllable.
Is that you've just sold me like your fucking amigo Bryant. Rina challenged, Chris. That mean anything to you? I just got the word. Sean approved tender. I got some fucking favela bon sicario calling me out for a 0.5% fee reduction. He's 20 years old, Chris. Priority challenge, 2 weeks notice. Sean fucking approved, man.
All right, listen.
Chris felt the sudden clarity of drive time set in, the suspended icy seconds of adrenaline injection.
Joaquin, listen to me carefully. That's not me. The tender is not authorized by me. I'm going to fix it for you. It's dead on the data down, I promise you. You'll never have to fight. Meantime...
Yeah, you say that. You said...
Joaquin, fucking listen to me. I got you out of Bogota in one piece, didn't I? I told you, I look after my people. Now, I don't have much time. I need you to get on to Barranco.
You want me to fucking work for you while...
Fucking listen, I said.
Whatever was in his voice must have gotten through. Lopez went quiet.
This is life or death, Joaquin. You get on to Barranco, and you tell him to stay away from that delivery beach next week. Tell him the rest of the arms aren't coming, and most likely there'll be an army death squad waiting for him instead. Tell him I'm under fire as much as he is, and it'll take me time to sort it out. He's got to fall back to safe ground and stay there until he hears from me. Have you got that?
Yeah.
Lopez was suddenly calm, as if the same adrenaline shiver had crept down the line and touched him with its time-warping cold.
Got it? You're in the arena too, huh?
Yeah, looks that way.
There was a finality about the way his own words sounded in his ears.
I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
Chris.
He held off the disconnect.
Yeah, still here.
Chris, listen to me. You're going into the arena. You stab low, man. Stab low, where they won't see it coming. And when you pull it out, you twist that fucker. Quadruples the wound. You got that?
Chris nodded distantly.
I got it, Joaquin. Thanks.
Hey. I'll be praying for you, man.
Philip Hamilton cut a surprisingly impressive figure in the presentation. Somehow the softness of the man disappeared, became confident bulk, and the resonance bass for a rich baritone voice that gave his words a longevity way beyond the moment of their utterance. His evidence was compelling. It was set up that way. But more powerful was the echo of what he said in the minds of his listeners. Chris looked around the table and saw heads nodding, Mike Bryant's included.
"Thus we convert," Hamilton declared vibrantly, "the uncertainty of change,
The certainty of post-land reform unrest and the probable budget deficit of the classic revolutionary regime at a stroke into a return to the profitable status quo we have enjoyed in the name for the last 20 years. It seems to me, ladies and gentlemen, that there is really no question or choice here, only a course of action that common sense and market return dictate. Thank you.
Applause rippled politely around the table. Murmured comments. Hamilton inclined his head and stood back a couple of steps. Louise Hewitt stood up.
I think that's pretty clear, thank you, Philip. But if there are any questions, perhaps we could have them now?
Yes.
Jack Notley raised a hand with completely superfluous deference. Every exec in the room shut up on the instant and pinned their gaze on the grizzled senior partner. Louise Hewitt folded herself back into her chair, and Philip Hamilton moved to take up the space she had left him. It was, Chris thought bitterly, choreographed tightly enough to be a Saturday night special dance act.
Yes, Jack?
The Americans,
Notley said with heavy emphasis that earned a sprinkling of laughter. The old man's nationalist eccentricity was well known in the division.
We know from Mike here's painstaking research that a Javaria Junior has, shall we say, a predilection for our transatlantic cousins, and they are unfortunately far closer to him both geographically and culturally than we are. I appreciate, Phil, that you're factoring in Corder's rap cap with the liaison work, and obviously Martin Meldrake. Well, he believes in a free market about as much as Ronald Reagan did.
More laughter. Louder this time.
So the secondary contractors he brings in will be exclusively U.S. firms. That much is clear. My question is, will this be enough? Will it hold off Conrad Rimshaw at Lloyd Paul, for example? Or the Saunders Group, or Grey Capital Solutions, or Moriarty Mills and Silver? Francisco Echevarria has had close dealings with all these gentlemen, or at least their Miami offices at one time or another. Can we be confident he will not bring them into play as soon as a budget review fails to please him?
Hear fucking hear, sleeted through Chris. Glad someone in this bunch of fucking sycophants spotted it. Hamilton cleared his throat.
That's a fair concern, Jack. I think it's indicative that the firms you've just named, with the exception of the Saunders Group, are all fast, hungry players from the New York corner. Sure, they'll all bear watching. But the point with Calder's is that they have the U.S. State Department's ear. That's a long-term relationship. In the case of Senator Barlow, we're talking 15 years, and there are others with ties almost as old. And, of course, as you say, the secondary contractors whom the Calder's Rap Cap people will bring in should have their own lobby network in place. If we combine all that pull with the influence we have on our own Foreign Office here in London, I feel sure we're in a position to repel any prospective boarders.
He got the laughter, too. He beamed around the table.
Any more questions?
Yeah, I've got a question for you. Chris climbed to his feet, trembling slightly. He stared at Hamilton. I'm curious as to why the fuck you're throwing away a guaranteed regime change, with a leader who is guaranteed 100% proof against U.S. involvement of any kind, in favor of this. Fucking carve-up. Sudden slither of shock around the table. Gasps, shuffling, the shaking of wiser heads. At his side, Mike Bryant was looking up at him in disbelief.
Ah, Chris.
Hamilton smiled briefly, like a comic to his audience just before the straight man gets it.
Now, before you go and get Mike's baseball bat, could I just point out that we're trying for a non-violent model here?
A couple of sniggers, but battened down. Officially, no one below partner level was supposed to know what had really happened to Hernan Echevarria. Nick Makin would have talked, Chris knew. He would have made sure word got out. But just how far they could all go along with Hamilton's indiscretion was unclear. Once again, gazes sought Jack Notley for his reaction. But the senior partner's features could have been pale granite.
"You stupid fuck," Chris said clearly, and the silence that followed it was absolute. "Do you really think Vicente Barranco is going to be stopped by some pissant cokehead dressed up in his old man's uniform? Do you really think he'll just go away?"
He saw Louise Hewitt tense on her way to getting up. saw Jack Notley lay a hand on her arm and shake his head almost imperceptibly. Philip Hamilton spotted the exchange as well, and his mouth contracted to almost anal proportions.
"Might I remind you, Mr. Faulkner, that you are talking to a partner? If you can't show the proper respect in this meeting, I will have you removed. Do you understand me?"
Chris's eyes widened slightly, and an unpleasant smile floated onto his face. "Try it," he said softly.
"Chris!" Notley's voice cracked across the room. "If you have anything to contribute, I'd like you to contribute it now and then sit down. This is a policy meeting, not the Royal Shakespeare Company."
Chris nodded. "All right." He looked around the room. "This is for the record. I know Vicente Barranco, and I'm telling you, if you try to fuck him over like this, he'll fade back into the Highlands like he has before, and he'll take the disenfranchised of the name with him by the thousands. And then, someday, maybe 5 years down the road, maybe next year, he'll be back. He'll be back, and he'll do what we were going to ask him to do in the first place. And when he's sitting in the Bogota Parliament Chamber, and Echevarria Jr. is facing a firing squad somewhere for crimes against humanity, we'll find ourselves on the wrong fucking side. He'll go to someone else, maybe Nakamura, maybe the Germans, and he will cut us out. No GDP percentage, no enterprise zone licenses, no arms trade, no supply-side contracts, no commodities angle, nothing. We'll just have a room full of angry Americans. And nothing to feed them with." More silence. Glances up and down the table in search of where this was going. Chris jerked his chin at Hamilton and sat down. Hamilton looked at Notley. The senior partner shrugged. Hamilton cleared his throat. "Well, Chris, thank you for that, academic insight. Of course, I appreciate you taking the time to come and give your view on an account you're no longer working, but let me just say I think we can handle one disgruntled marquista, and indeed there are already initiatives in place." Chris grinned like a skull. "He won't be there, Hamilton. I already called Lopez, told him to steer Barranco well clear of the beach. When the Cobain doesn't show up, and Junior's pet thugs do, either they'll find nothing. Or better yet, Barranco'll catch them in an ambush and slaughter them. After that, he'll fade like a fucking ghost." The room erupted before he finished. Uproar from the gathered ranks of execs, half of them on their feet, pointing and shouting, not all wholly opposed to Chris, it seemed. Hamilton yelling across the melee of voices, something about fucking professional misconduct, Notley bellowing for order. The door burst open and security rushed the room, wielding non-lethal weaponry. Louise Hewitt went to stop them, hands and voice raised to make herself understood above the noise. In the midst of it all, Mike turned to Chris, face distorted with shock and anger.
"Are you fucking insane?" he hissed.
It took 10 minutes to clear the conference room, and even then security weren't happy about leaving the partners with Chris. They'd heard their own set of rumors about the Echevarria incident.
"It'll be fine," said Notley. "Really, Hermione, I appreciate your diligence, but we're all colleagues here. Just tempers flaring, that's all. A bit of misplaced road rage. Just keep a couple of your people outside the door, that'll be fine."
He ushered the guard captain out and closed the doors, then turned back to the table. In the places they had occupied when the room was filled, Chris, Mike, Louise Hewitt, and Philip Hamilton sat staring at their respective patches of polished wood. Notley came back to the head of the table and stood looking at them.
"Right," he said grimly. "Let's sort this out, shall we?"
Louise Hewitt made an impatient gesture. "I don't see anything to sort out, Jack. Faulkner's just admitted to gross professional misconduct."
"Yeah, that's..." "Chris, will you shut up?" roared Notley. "You are not a partner, nor will you ever be if you cannot behave in a civilized fashion. Do as you're told and be fucking quiet."
"Louise is right, Jack." Hamilton's voice was soft and calm, at odds with the rage he'd shown earlier. He was back on comfortable ground. "Warning Barranco has endangered a delicate piece of policy restructuring. At a minimum, it's cost us a possible bargaining chip with Echevarria. At worst, it's given succor to a terrorist who could provide us with insurgency problems for the next decade." "He was a freedom fighter last week," muttered Chris. Louise Hewitt turned a look of distilled contempt on him.
"Let me ask you a question, Chris," she said lightly. "Would it be fair to say that you've become political where the name is concerned? That you've been contaminated by local issues?"
Chris looked at Notley. "Am I allowed to answer that?"
"Yes. But you'll keep your tone civil and show some respect, is that understood? This isn't some basement fight club in the zones."
"Yes, I understand that." Chris jabbed a finger at Hamilton. "What I don't understand is our junior partner's system of communication. Until this morning, I had no idea either that I had been relieved of duty on the name account, or that we were reversing our established client relationship."
"Echevarria is the established..."
"Philip!"
Notley wagged a finger at the junior partner.
"Let him finish."
"In fact," Chris saw the opening and accelerated into it, "the client change was news to me until this meeting, which wasn't helpful. If I warned Barranco off, it was because I thought someone was running infiltration into the account."
"Oh, please." Louise Hewitt pulled a face. "This is your job on the line, Chris. Surely you can do better than that."
"This morning, Louise, I received a direct call from the captain of the sub-freighter we're using to ship Barranco's arms." "She's stuck in Faslane, waiting for freight that isn't coming, because this," Chris indicated Hamilton, "genius has had it rerouted to the name military. Only he didn't think to inform me of the fact. So all I can assume is outside interference. I act accordingly. I protect our client as best I can. I get slammed for it, when the real problem here is a lack of top-down communication."
"You're lying," Hamilton said angrily.
He also had seen the loophole.
"Am I, Philip?"
Chris turned to gesture at Mike Bryant. "Ask Mike. He's been as much in the dark as I have. He knows all about the sub-freighter call, because the two of us were both trying to work out what the fuck was going on this morning. Right, Mike?"
Bryant shifted in his seat. For the first time ever that Chris could remember, he looked uncomfortable.
Notley's gaze sharpened.
"Mike?"
"Yeah, that's right," Bryant sighed. "Sorry, Phil, Louise. Chris is right. You should have told us earlier."
Hamilton leaned across the table, flushed.
"Bryant, you knew—"
"I knew there was a policy meeting, and yeah, from the hints you dropped, I guessed the way it was going. But there was nothing solid, Phil. And nothing about the shipments. You know," sideways glance at his friend, "I didn't know what Chris was going to do, but I couldn't tell him for sure what was going on either. I can see why he would have played it the way he did."
The room was still. A glance crackled between Hamilton and Hewitt. No one spoke. Jack Notley steepled his fingers.
"Is there anything else?"
he asked quietly.
Louise Hewitt shrugged. "Only that what we've heard is a pack of lies designed to hide the fact that Chris has gone political on us."
"Anything constructive?"
asked Notley, still more softly. "Yes," said Chris, thinking of Lopez, tossed into the arena and up against a 20-year-old blade sicario who'd be savage with favela poverty and sight of a way out. Thinking of Barranco, machine-gunned to death on a darkened beach, blood leaking into the sand under a shattering of glass-shard stars. "I am not political. My reasons for backing Vicente Barranco have nothing to do with politics, and anyone who wants to call that into question can see me on the road."
Chapter 43.
"You are a lying motherfucker, Chris."
Mike Bryant paced back and forth in front of the BMW, furious. His feet crunched in the hard shoulder gravel. Off to one side, a breeze stirred the grass beside the motorway ramp. He stopped and jabbed a finger at Chris.
"You have turned political, haven't you? Fucking Barranco got to you, didn't he?"
Chris leaned on the still warm hood of the car, arms folded. The orbital stretched away below them, deserted as far as the eye could see in both directions. After the confines of the shorn block, the sky over them seemed enormous. They'd driven for less than an hour, but it felt as if they stood at the edge of the world.
"Oh, give me a fucking break. You're accusing me of politics. A week ago Barranco was the horse to back, now suddenly he's unprofitable. What is that, Mike? That's not political?"
"The numbers make sense," said Bryant.
"The numbers?
Chris came off the hood of the BMW, taut with rage. "The fucking numbers? That shit is made up, Mike. You can make the numbers tell you any fucking thing you want them to. What about the numbers that made sense for Branko? What happened to them? What are we, economists all of a sudden? You want to draw me a fucking curve? It's got nothing to do with reality, Mike." "You know that." Mike looked away.
"The fact remains, Chris. You're in way too close with Branko. You've got to come off the account. Let Hamilton run with it. See what happens."
"Great. And meanwhile, what happens to Joaquin Lopez?"
"That's not important."
Bryant made fists, punched exasperatedly off into the wind.
"Fuck, Chris! Pay attention, will you? You can't get personal on this thing. It's just business.
Lopez has been undercut. That's all there is to it. If this new guy can do the same work for a percentage point less commission, what the fuck are we doing still working with Lopez anyway?" "It's 0.5%, Mike. And he's a 20-year-old sicario, straight out of the favelas. How do we know what he'll do?"
"If he's hungry, he'll do well. They always do."
"Oh, what the fuck are you talking about, Mike? You were at the briefing. This guy is cheap and aggressive, and that's all we know. He could be fucking illiterate for all the background Hamilton's shown us. This is a bad call, Mike. This isn't business. It's a fucking greed call. Can't you see that?"
"What I see, Mike, is that you're cruising for a fall."
Mike's voice softened, but it was the gentle tug of a steel tow cable taking up slack. He moved in, stood close.
"I see why you're acting like this, but it's no good. You're out of control. You're unmanageable, and we can't afford that, not in any of us. I'm sorry about what happened to your dad, really I am."
Chris flinched away. Mike caught his arm.
"No, I am. I'm sorry about the zones, and your mum, and everything that's happened to you. But that's the past, Chris, and it's over. It doesn't give you an excuse to fuck up everyone else's life around here. Now I'm telling you, listen to me, Chris, I'm telling you, you're off the name account. End of story. I'm the one who brought you aboard in the first place, and now I'm cutting you loose. It's not like you haven't got enough else to worry about. Fuck, Chris, why don't you go home? Talk to Carla. Sort your life out."
Chris shoved him away, both palm heels into the chest. For a flashpoint second, both men almost dropped into a karate stance.
"I've told you before, Mike. I don't need marital advice from you." "Chris, you're throwing away the best—" "Shut the fuck up!"
The yell lashed out, fury etched with pain. "What do you know about it, Mike? What the fuck do you know about it?"
"I know—"
Chris cut across him savagely.
"Try staying faithful to Suki for 10 minutes, why don't you? Try acting like a responsible father and husband for a change. Get your dick out of Sally Hunting and Liz Linshaw and whoever else you're dipping it into these days. There. You enjoying this, Mike? Doesn't feel good, does it?"
"I'm not seeing Liz at the moment," Mike said quietly. "She's got a lot of work on. And I haven't fucked Sally Hunting in better than 6 years. You want to make sure of your facts before you start mouthing off."
"I couldn't have put it better myself."
They stood, twitchily, facing each other across one corner of the BMW's hood. Very distantly, the sound came of a single vehicle on the orbital. Finally, Mike Bryant shrugged.
"All right," he said, "if that's the way you want it. But what I said before stands. You're off the name account. You're—"
His phone queeped for attention. He grimaced and fished it out, pressed it impatiently to his ear.
"Yeah, Bryant? Out on the orbital, why?" "Yeah, he's right here."
He handed the phone to Chris.
"Hewitt," he said.
Louise Hewitt sat behind her desk, hands spread on its surface as if she might find built-in weaponry there to blast Chris into grease on the carpet. Her tone was chilly.
"Well, I'm glad you're back from your picnic in the country. There are a couple of things we need to clear up."
Chris waited.
"Primarily, I'm concerned to get your files for the name transferred to Philip Hamilton's desk as soon as electronically possible. He'll need your Panama City contacts, the background data on Branko, and any of the other insurgents you did work for on Hammett McCall." She offered him a thin smile. "Since we're now back in the business of helping the regime flatten its opponents, anything you have will be of some value."
"Then maybe you should shut down the agency tender on Lopez,"
He knows the ground. That's value right there. She looked him up and down, like a specimen of something she'd thought was extinct.
Remarkable, Chris. Your capacity for inappropriate loyalty, I mean. Quite remarkable. However, I think we all agreed at the briefing that a clean break is essential.
There's no telling what inconvenient loyalties Lopez himself may have. Perhaps he has, bonded with Vicente Barranco as strongly as you have. The man is, by all accounts, quite inspiring.
Nothing. He wouldn't give her the satisfaction. But I digress, Hewitt said smoothly. In addition to the file transfer, I want you to prepare a formal statement of apology for your behavior today, for posting on our intranet. First and foremost, that means an apology for your zone-mannered outburst in Philip's briefing, but it's not limited to that. There are other matters. I feel, and our senior partner concurs, that the apology had better also cover your failure to consult your colleagues before taking client-related decisions.
Notley said that?
The thin smile again. He's not on your side, Chris, whatever you think. Don't make that mistake. Notley's concerned wholly with the success of Sean Conflict Investment, with maybe a side interest in waving the Union Jack when he gets the chance. Call it a hobby. That's it. That's the whole story. At the moment, he still thinks you're a necessary component for the division to do well. Thus far, I've failed to persuade him otherwise, but I think with your help today he's coming around. I told you once you'd disappoint him, and I think we're closing on that.
That'd make you happy, wouldn't it?
What'd make me happy, Chris, is to take back our plastic from your lightly charred and broken corpse.
She shrugged.
I'm unlikely to get that chance, of course. Policy doesn't allow us to duel across partner-employee lines. But I will, I think, live to see you booted out of Sean and back to the riverside slum existence you so eminently suit. I've told you before, and it's becoming clearer by the day, you do not belong here.
Oddly, the line made him grin. Well, you're not the only person who thinks that, Louise. It got him a sharp look, but Hewitt wasn't biting.
Notley and I have also agreed that you'd better draft the apology to Philip's specifications, a first draft by this evening. That's a minimum requirement if you intend to continue with this firm. Philip's in uplink conference right now with Echevarria, but he'll be done by 6. Take it in for his approval then. You might like to add a verbal apology at the same time.
She looked at him, grim amusement curled in the corner of her mouth.
A personal touch, say. A little bridge building.
He walked out, wordless. Louise Hewitt watched him go, and as the door slammed, the smile broadened on her lips. It took him the walk to his own office to decide. 2 flights of stairs and a corridor. He saw no one. He reached the door with his name on it, stood facing the metalled slab for 10 seconds, and then turned away. He was a dozen paces away and accelerating before it had properly dawned on him what he was going to do. I look after my people. He found his way almost absently, most of him thinking about Carla and how fucking delighted she'd be to see his life come tumbling down like this. The main door to the conference room was locked, but the entrance to the covert viewing chamber was on a code he knew. He let himself in, peered through the gloom and the glass panel. In the conference room, Philip Hamilton sat opposite a hollow of Francisco Echevarria. The dictator's son was dressed in his usual Susanna Ingram splendor. He looked hard and implacable against Hamilton's soft and light-suited untidiness.
"Are aware that you have friends in Miami, and we have no desire to exclude them from the proceedings. You should certainly speak with Martin Meldrick at Calder's, who will, I'm sure."
Enough. He coded himself through the connecting door, stood abruptly behind Hamilton. Echevarria's eyes widened as he stepped inside the pickup field of the holoscanner, and he knew that in the chamber on the other side of the world he had appeared like a ghost at the feast. Hamilton turned around in his chair.
Faulkner.
He wasn't worried yet, just surprised. Anger edged his cultured tones.
What the hell do you think you're doing, interrupting me with a client?
Chris grinned down at him.
You wanted a statement from me.
Yes, in due course. At the moment I'm busy. You can... Chris hit him, open-handed, swinging from the shoulder. It took Hamilton across the side of the head and tipped him out of the chair. First draft. Chris grabbed him up by the hair and hit him again in the face, this time with a fist. He felt the junior partner's nose break. He punched him once more for security and let go. Hamilton slumped to the floor like a filled sack. He turned about, reached Francisco Echevarria with his eyes. "Hello, Paco." He got his breath back, straightened up the chair. "You don't know me, do you? Allow me to introduce myself. I'm the man who beat your father to death." Echevarria's face tightened.
"Are you fucking crazy, man? You didn't kill my father?"
Chris settled into the chair. "No, I did. The terrorist stuff was something we set up to cover what really happened. The CE... those guys, they went with the claim because it gives them prestige. Your father was a sick fuck, and anyone killing him could claim they'd done a good day's work."
"You're gonna fucking die for that, man."
The dictator's son was staring at him, transfixed.
"You're gonna fucking die."
"Oh, please. As I was saying, there's no way that bunch are well enough organized to do something like that on the streets of London and get away with it. So, as I said, I killed your old man. I beat him to death in this very room with a baseball bat. All part of a day's work for the Shawn Corporation. Check with Mike Bryant if you don't believe me. I'm a colleague of his." Echevarria's voice came out strangled.
"You..."
"It's what we do here, Paco. Neoliberal commercial management. Global mayhem. Remote control death and destruction. Market forces in action. If you don't like it..." Hamilton charged him from the side. He had time to be impressed. Fat fuck didn't look like he had it in him. Then the chair went over and the junior partner was on top of him, blooded nose spattering down into his face, soft hands digging into the cords of his throat with surprising strength. Chris wasted no time struggling. He got a grip on the little finger of Hamilton's right hand, curled it back, and snapped it. Hamilton yelped and let go. Chris came up from the floor like a hinge and punched the partner in the throat. Hamilton lurched back, just on his feet, clutching at the point of impact. Somewhere on the other side of the world, Echevarria was yelling in Spanish. Chris got to his feet, stalked toward Hamilton. The partner's eyes widened. Chris threw a punch. Hamilton ducked and fended with a rusty boxing move, the other hand still at his throat. There wasn't much strength in it, and he came up panting. Impatiently, Chris repeated the punch, snagged Hamilton's wrist with an Aikido hold he knew, and jerked the partner off balance toward him. He punched low into the expansive gut, and as Hamilton spasmed, he grabbed him around the neck and yanked up and around. It had the fury of the whole day behind it. It snapped Hamilton's neck. Chris heard the muffled crack, and as the partner went limp in his grip, the rage drained out of him. He let go and Hamilton hit the floor. He turned back to Echevarria and the suited aides who were crowding into the holocaust around him. They stared at him like frightened children. He cleared his throat. "Now." Something cold and jagged slapped him. He blinked and raised one arm to look at the mass of silvery wire mesh that had come out of nowhere and wrapped around his side. He was starting to turn to the door behind him when the stun gun web sparked and went off with a smell like scorching plastic. The jolt flung him hard against the table, where he clung for a moment, staring. In the open doorway, Louise Hewitt stood with the stun gun still leveled and watched him collapse. The last thing he saw was her smile. Chapter 44. The cell measured about 3 meters on a side and smelled very faintly of fresh paint, thick pastel layers of which coated the walls. There was a comfortable steel frame bed against one such wall, a 3-drawer desk under the window, and an ensuite bathroom capsule in one corner. Next to the capsule, plain white towels hung on a heated rack. Next to that, there was hanging space and boxed shelving for his clothes. The fixtures were good quality wood and metal, and the window looked out over the river through glass that betrayed its toughened qualities only via the tiny red triangle logo in one corner. The whole place was no worse than some hotels Chris had seen on assignment, and it was in considerably better condition than any of the rooms in Eric Nyquist's Brundtland Estate apartment. As far as he could work out, he was the only person in the block. Guest of honour, he thought vaguely, as he went to sleep the second night. Full run of the facilities. The truth was, the corporate police didn't seem to know what to do with him. They'd taken his phone and his wallet on arrival, but beyond that basic security measure, they appeared to be making it up as they went along. They weren't used to holding executives for anything more serious than drunken affray or the occasional white-collar accounting misdemeanor. Most of their duties went the other way. Investigation of crimes and apprehension of suspects where the victims were corporate, but the criminals were not. Any one of that stripe who made it to custody alive would be summarily handed over to the conventional police so that the grubby business of state law enforcement could be set in motion. Here the victim was corporate, but so was the offender.
Say what?
Murder, they were saying. But hell, don't these guys off each other on the road practically every month?
That's different.
It was confusing for everybody. In the ensuing vacuum, Chris was accorded a status somewhere between cherished celebrity and dangerous lunatic. The first role, at least, he was learning how to play. The days crept along, like slow, bulky files downloading. He got meals in his cell at 3 appointed times daily, delivered on a tray by 2 uniformed officers, one of whom watched from the door while the other set down the food on the desk. An hour after each meal, the tray was removed by the same team, but only after all items of cutlery and crockery had been checked off on a palm pad. Both men were friendly enough, but they never let the conversation get beyond pleasantries, and they watched him warily all the time. Impotence was 2 clenched fists and a fizzing wire through the head. Lopez, Barranco, the name account. Nothing he could do. A different team, also all male, escorted him out of the cell for an hour's exercise after breakfast and lunch. They marched him along well-cared-for corridors and down a stairwell that led out to an internal quadrangle. There was a profusion of plants and trees planted in shingle beds, a complex step-structured bronze fountain, and a high angled glass roof covering a third of the open space. His escort left him alone in the quad, closed the doors, and watched him from a glassed-in mezzanine gallery above. The first couple of times he paced back and forth, aimlessly, less out of any real inclination than from a vague sense of what was expected of him. Once he realized this, he stopped, and spent most of his allocated hour sitting on the edge of the fountain, lost in the noise it made. Knotted, hopeless plans to save Joaquin Lopez from the arena, and daydreams of driving the Saab. When it became apparent he wasn't leaving any time soon, he got clothes. 3 changes of good quality casuals in dark colours and a dozen sets of cotton underwear. He asked the woman who came to fit him how she wanted him to pay, cash or cards, and she looked embarrassed. "We bill your firm," she admitted finally. He got no visitors, for which he was obscurely grateful. He wouldn't have known what to say to anybody he knew. Between meals, the hours stretched out. He couldn't remember a time when less had been expected of him. One of his warders offered to let him have some books, but when the promised haul arrived, it consisted of a bare 6 battered paperbacks by authors Chris had never heard of. He picked one at random, a luridly violent far-future crime novel about a detective who could seemingly exchange bodies at will. But the subject matter was alien to him, and his attention drifted. It all seemed very far-fetched. He was asked if he wanted paper and pens, and said yes, reflexively, then didn't know what to do with them. He tried to write an account of the events leading up to Philip Hamilton's death, as much as anything to get it clear in his own head, but he kept having to cross out what he'd written and start farther back. When his first line read, "My father was murdered by an executive called Edward Quain," he gave up. Perhaps inspired by the novel he was trying to read, he wrote an imaginary brief for the name account set 5 years into a future where Barranco had taken power and instituted wide-ranging land reform. It also seemed very far-fetched. He started a letter to Carla,
and tore it up after less than 10 lines. He couldn't think of anything worth telling her. The week ended. Another started. Sean came for him. He was on morning walkabout, cheated of his usual seat at the fountain by a persistent heavy drizzle that drenched the exposed patio area and kept him penned under the glass roof. His escort had obligingly dragged a bench out of somewhere for him, and now he sat at one end of it, and stared out at the curtain of rain falling half a meter away. The plants, at least, seemed to be enjoying it. The door to the quad snapped open, and he flicked a surprised glance at his watch. He'd only been there 20 minutes. He looked up and saw Louise Hewitt standing there. It was the first time he'd seen her since she'd shot him with the stun gun. He looked back at the rain.
"Morning, Faulkner. Mind if I sit down?"
He stared down at his hands.
"I guess they'll stop me if I try to break your neck."
"Try to lay a fucking finger on me and I'll stop you myself," she said mildly. "You're not the only one with karate training, you know."
He shrugged.
"I'll take that as a yes, then."
He felt the bench shift slightly as she lowered herself onto it at the other end. They sat a meter apart. The rain fell through the silence, hissing softly.
"Liz Linshaw says hi," Hewitt told him finally.
It jerked his head around.
"Well," she amended, "that's a paraphrase. Actually, she says, 'You fucking bitch, you can't hold him without charges this long. I want to see him.' She's wrong about that, of course. We can hold you pretty much indefinitely."
Chris looked away again, jaw set.
"We don't plan to, though. In fact, your release papers should come through sometime tomorrow morning. You can go home, or back to that expensive hotel fucknest you've been maintaining. Want to know how come?"
He locked down the urge to ask, to give anything. It was hard to do. He was hungry for detail from outside, for anything to engage the frantically spinning wheels in his head.
"So I'll tell you anyway. Tomorrow's Thursday. You should be out by lunchtime at worst. That gives you the best part of a day before you drive. We've posted for a Friday challenge. It's traditional at Sean. Gives everyone the weekend to get used to the result."
"What the fuck are you talking about, Hewitt?" The insolence shrouded the question enough that he could justify breaking his silence.
"What challenge?"
"The partnership challenge, for Philip Hamilton's post."
He coughed a laugh.
"I don't want Hamilton's fucking job."
"Oh, yes, you do. In fact, you issued a formal notice of challenge just before you killed him, citing unprofessional conduct over the name account, ironically enough."
She reached into her jacket and produced a palm pad.
"I can show it to you if you like."
"No, thanks. I don't know what shit you're cooking up, Hewitt, but it won't start. You know the policy. You told me yourself last week. No partner-employee crossover."
"Well, yes, granted your actions were unorthodox. But as you know, our senior partner is a big fan of policy-making by precedent. He's agreed that we can blur the distinction in this case. Apparently he's had you in mind for partner status for quite a while. You, or Mike Bryant, of course."
And then it all came crashing down on him, like a slum clearance he'd watched as a kid. Explosions ripping through what he thought was solid from one side to the other, clean, straight lines of structure tipping, curtsying, and dissolving into a chaos of tumbling rubble and dust, while a huddled crowd watched. He couldn't see the resulting wreckage clearly yet, but he sensed its outlines.
"Mike won't drive against me," he said without conviction.
Hewitt smiled.
"Yes, he will. I've talked to him. More precisely, I've talked to him about equity, capital, wealth, partner-safe status, professional versus unprofessional behavior, and the dangers of unmanageability. Oh, and the identity of your mystery hotel guest over the last couple of weeks."
"The fuck are you talking about?"
But as he said it, the sliding sense of despair was overwhelming because he already knew.
"Don't be obtuse, Chris. I've got in-desk micro-cam footage from Liz's house and the hotel, too. Should have seen Mike's face when he saw that stuff."
"Bullshit."
"No," she said almost kindly. "I've been modeling this one for months, Chris. I mean, come on. Who do you think sent you Donna Dredd's little performance in the first place?"
She waited for a response, saw she was getting none, and sighed.
Okay. Linshaw was already leaning pretty hard in your direction. She's such a little tart with the driving thing anyway. But even so, I think I deserve some credit. If it weren't for me, you'd probably still be grinding through the same stale old fidelity numbers with your Norwegian grease monkey.
Chris nodded to himself. The shock was still coming, in waves. You set me up with Hamilton, didn't you? You knew what I'd do.
It seemed likely.
Hewitt examined her nails modestly. To tell the truth, I wasn't sure I'd get a result this good. Putting you and Hamilton on a collision course was an obvious no-lose strategy, and the Lopez Barranco stuff looked likely to pull you in. You proved that with Echevarria Sr. Little favour called in at the Langley end, tip you off the account, and off we go. But even so, Chris, I was impressed. You really managed to fuck up beyond my wildest dreams. I don't know what you were thinking. If you were thinking...
You wouldn't understand, Chris said distantly.
No, I do understand. You're hooked on Barranco's shiny new dream. Actually, it's a pretty grubby old dream, but let's leave that. And some macho loyalty thing for Joaquin Lopez. I just wonder what you thought trashing Hamilton was going to achieve.
It was a ray of light, with an almost grin. You're wrong, Louise. Trashing Hamilton was incidental. He was just in the way. The point is, your deal with Echevarria is fucked. He'll never touch Sean again.
Well, that remains to be seen. He's a smarter young man than you give him credit for, and if we can show him your charred corpse with Mike Bryant's boot on it, well, who knows?
He folded his arms. I'm not doing it, Louise.
Oh, yes, you are.
Her voice turned momentarily ugly. Because if you don't drive, then Phil Hamilton's death is just murder, and you'll be getting a swift ride to the organ bank.
Those are your choices, Chris. Die on the road, or die strapped to a gurney at St. Bart's. Either way is fine with me.
She leaned closer, close enough that he could smell her perfume under the rain, clean and sharp and lightly spiced. Her voice was a serrated murmur.
And whichever it is, Chris, when it happens, as you're going under, you just remember Nick Makin.
Chris...
Chris looked at her, not really surprised. Makin, huh?
That's right.
She sat back again.
Makin.
So I called it from the beginning. Your toy boy got bumped for me, and you sent him to kill me. He shook his head. Him and his gangwit proxies.
That was brave of you.
There's no scent about it, Chris. He hated you for free. If anything...
She closed her mouth, looked away. She blinked.
If anything, I tried to talk him down because I knew it wasn't necessary. I knew you'd fuck up sooner or later.
And don't talk to me about brave, Chris. Not with Mitsuha Jones, shot through the head at close range while she was injured and trapped in wreckage. Not with the blood of an 18-year-old man on your hands. You're no fucking different from me in the end.
No. He spotted the weak spot and stabbed at it. He mimicked her savagely. Tried to talk him down.
Come on, Louise. If you'd wanted to stop Makin, you could have. He wasn't that strong.
You let it happen because it suited the play. Tell yourself what you like in the wee small hours, but don't try to sell that shit to me. In the end, he was just another pawn.
Pawn?